Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order. This meeting is being called pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. And I want to make sure that members of the public are aware that the meeting materials, including the agenda, have been posted to our committee website. So you can find that online with our House Early Childhood website. And so with that, we're going to have the roll taken. Ms. Chambers, if you can do that, please.
Yes. Representative Pinto, chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wasilewicz.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Awesome. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. And Representative Pryor, if you could move approval of the minutes for February 11th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any additions or corrections, members, to those minutes? I'll wait just a second. Okay, not hearing anything. All in favor of approval of the February 11th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes and our minutes have been approved for February 11th. Thank you, Representative Pryor. So members, we've been hearing over the last few weeks about a really quite extensive array of programs across three departments that impact young children and their families. And so today we're going to be hearing in a way of wrap of a bat, two efforts by the current administration to connect and coordinate those programs. One is the Children's Cabinet that Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan have created to connect the programs. And then also there's a federally supported initiative called the Preschool Development Grant. And then we'll lead into hearing the governor's budget proposals from the different departments as well. So that is the plan. So we're going to start with Ms. Hoganson, if you can identify yourself for the record, and then proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Hoganson, and I'm the Policy Director for the Children's Cabinet. The Children's Cabinet is housed within Minnesota Management and Budget and is an interagency partnership the governor has charged with helping make Minnesota the best place for each and every child to grow up. I'm pleased to be here this morning with our agency partners and leaders from the Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services to present an update on exciting plans and progress through the Preschool Development Grant, as well as to share the governor's budget recommendations focused on early childhood programs in these three agencies. Before the presentation, I wanted to briefly share about our Children's Cabinet structure and the work and collaboration it supports to drive the outcomes and proposals we will share this morning. At the governor and lieutenant governor's direction, the Children's Cabinet works to ensure Minnesota is the top place to live for all children, no matter their race or zip code. With the governor's charge to put children and families at the center of state government, the Children's Cabinet was relaunched in August of 2019 to include the 10 agencies in our statute, plus 12 additional. The cabinet itself is chaired by the governor and lieutenant governor, and the Children's Cabinet staff also convene a senior leadership team, action teams in priority areas, and lead in cross-agency COVID-19 response work groups and efforts to ensure coordination, accountability, and action toward equitable outcomes for Minnesota children and families, prenatal to young adulthood. By aligning strategies, programs, and services, the cabinet seeks to create a more efficient and effective government. The Children's Cabinet is focused on broad external stakeholder engagement to inform policy and practice, including through our advisory councils, which are the Children's Cabinet Advisory Council and the State Advisory Council on Early Education and Care. Next slide. With a focus on child-centered government, whole family approach, and data and results-based accountability through community engagement and feedback, the Children's Cabinet is focused on five priority areas. Healthy beginnings, or infant and maternal health, with a focus on the disparity this committee has heard about for Black and American Indian women and babies in particular. Child care and education access, early education access, mental health and well-being, housing stability, and educational opportunity. You will see these priorities reflected in the information and budget proposals presented today. Next slide. The Children's Cabinet focuses on three strategies: convening and aligning, accountability and action, and policy platform and strategy. The Children's Cabinet worked with agencies and the Governor's Office to support development of agency budget and COVID-19 federal funding proposals related to children and families from a cross-agency and whole family lens. Through our leadership engagement, cross-agency action teams and priority areas, and convening of cross-agency discussions, the structure of the Children's Cabinet supports an overarching view and focus on children and families in order to lift up priorities and catch gaps and leverage stakeholder input along the way. Children and families' lives are touched by each of our state agencies. Children don't come in pieces, so the work of policymaking demands coordination. The proposals you will hear today, of course, are not the only ones in the governor's budget that touch the lives of young children and their families. There are other investments in the budget, including in housing supports, tax credits, other working family supports, and childcare related proposals that aim to support the needs of the whole child, prioritize equity, and support those disproportionately impacted, including our littlest Minnesotans, by the effects of COVID-19 and structural inequities. Finally, a quick overview of this morning's presentation. First, you will hear an update on the preschool development grant goals and activities, which is a prime example of ways the state, through interagency collaboration and the Children's Cabinet, is breaking down silos, coordinating services, and prioritizing community feedback loops and whole family supports. Then you will hear about the governor's early childhood budget proposals, first from MDE, then MDH, then DHS. And Mr. Chair, with that, I'll turn it over to you for the next part of our presentation by Amanda Varley from the Department of Education.
Thank you, Ms. Hoganson. And Ms. Varley, please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Amanda Varley, and I manage our preschool development grant, and I'm based at the Minnesota Department of Education. So our preschool development grant builds on the vision that was developed through the early childhood systems reform work, that by focusing on children who are experiencing racial, geographic, and economic inequities, all children will be born healthy and thrive within their communities. The grant itself was funded by the federal government, and it focuses on birth through age 5, but Minnesota's approach to it really is thinking through prenatal through grade 3, because we know it's so important to focus on prenatal as well as those transitions into the early grades. As Stephanie mentioned, it's a partnership between the Departments of Education, Health, Human Services, along with the Children's Cabinet, and it's a $27 million grant that ends on December 30th, 2022. It's important to recognize that the overall goal of the grant is how do we have inclusive and responsive practices, programs, and policies. So it's also important to recognize that the preschool development grant builds on a long history of cross-agency systems efforts. So many of you might be familiar with Race to the Top, which is another one of these federal systems building grants that we had between 2012 to 2015. And then we have the Two Generation Policy Network that started in 2016 that really pushed the work to be thinking about the whole family approach. We know that children come with many adults in their network and in their families. And so thinking about how can we be supporting not only the children, but also the adults who are part of their lives. And then I mentioned the early childhood systems reform work, which is what created a shared vision across our agencies. And then in 2019, we started our preschool development grant work. And the first year of the grant was really a planning grant. So we were funded with a nearly $5 million grant in 2019. That's primary objectives were to create a comprehensive needs assessment across our departments. And this was created in strong partnership with the Department of Health's Title V needs assessment. And then we also have a strategic plan that shows the overall goals of our agencies and what we're working towards together. So the strategic plan is on the next slide, just a quick capture of it that I'm not going to go into detail on. But again, the vision at the center and overall goals of how do we make it easier for children and families to get what they need. I encourage you to look through the quotes that are on here. I know you have a PDF of this presentation, and we did over 150 listening sessions throughout the state throughout 2019 with community partners. And within those listening sessions, the quotes really capture kind of high level what we heard, but we were able to hear from folks on all level at all 11 tribal nations, as well as individuals who spoke 8 different languages. And so had a really great cross section of Minnesota. On the next slide, we talk about our guiding principles. And so when we did our community engagement, we of course heard about the need for more access to childcare, a well-supported workforce, home visiting, all of these things that are central to how we think about early childhood. But then the undercurrent of all of those conversations were really the guiding principles and how community expected us to approach the work. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but I do want to highlight a couple. And one of them is intersectionality. And so when we talk to children, or when we talk to families and providers, a lot of what we heard was the idea of kind of the overlapping either social identities of individuals that experience and how they experience the world. And then also we heard about the intersectionality of the systems that families are experiencing and how critical it was that when we talk about early childhood, that we're also talking about housing, employment status of families, transportation. All of those became critical components. And that's where the Children's Cabinet has been really great partners in this work, because they've been able to be a venue to connect us with other agencies to be solving these problems in a holistic way for families. I also want to highlight racial equity. We know that a lot of the disparities in Minnesota primarily fall along racial lines. And so the work of the grant has a particular focus to African-American and American Indian communities. And then again, I'll mention whole family systems, because this is so important that we really need to make sure that we have stability for the adults that are working with our children and who are the parents of our children in supporting our kids. We know it takes a village, and we need to make sure that it's part of a well-supported system. So on the next slide, I just want to also share our leadership structure. So Stephanie talked about how, and really this should be a vertical slide, but alas, PowerPoint doesn't quite do that. Stephanie talked about the Children's Cabinet and then the senior leadership team. Underneath that, we have an interagency leadership team that's made up of agency directors across education, health, human services, as well as DEED. They've been meeting for years, and it also includes folks who are leading specific initiatives such as the Two Generation Policy Network and preschool development grant and other initiatives. And this is a group that meets to have alignment between our early childhood systems and really be thinking about it in a holistic way. And then work groups is kind of a generic term, but ever since the time of Race to the Top, it is very common practice in our work culture to have cross-agency groups of people that are meeting to solve specific issues related to early childhood. So now I want to talk a bit about the grant itself. So the renewal grant has four primary activities, and there are additional that I'll talk about in a few minutes. But these are kind of the big bucket items. So one is exploring technology to better coordinate our eligibility and services across agencies. So we heard again and again from families that they're telling their story so many different places and how that's really challenging. And then we also heard from providers that it's hard to coordinate across those who are working with families to really make sure that we're fully wrapping around families and have a holistic experience for how they're getting access to what they need. And then we have Help Me Connect, which is a system that right now how it exists is that it is a resource page that will have a depository of resources for children and families and a way to look up what resources there are in your community. So I could, you know, I'm from Dundas, Minnesota. I could look up what are dental services within that area for my child. And then eventually what we'll be building into it is a referral system. So not only are you looking up those services, but you can get a direct referral to that service. We'll also be piloting, we're in the midst of executing contracts for 10 local cross-agency hubs that will be throughout the state that we'll be piloting. These hubs are local collaborations. They look a little bit different in each community based on what are the programs available in that community, as well as what partnerships exist or will be planned to be built within that community. And then they'll be testing Help Me Connect as a resource. These are the human navigators as a part of that work. And then we'll also have a learning partnership with these local hubs so that we can be learning at the state how we can have, again, those inclusive and responsive policies, practices, and programs. And finally, we are supporting community solutions to community identified challenges. We heard this again and again in community engagement that my community knows what children and families need, and we would love to be supported in doing that work. And so these are grants, they're the Community Solutions Fund grants that were funded with state dollars, that our federal preschool development grant dollars were just able to support those in going further and adding some additional learning components to that work. So all of these four activities are really interrelated. So we think about the community hubs and the community solutions grants as the ways that the state is learning from and investing in community. We think of those hubs and Help Me Connect as the human connection for navigating programs and services for children and families. And then we think about Help Me Connect and eligibility and service portal as how we're coordinating services for those families. And now I would like to dive a little bit deeper into a couple of these. And one is the hubs. And so we mentioned—
Ms. Varley, I should just know we've got just a couple minutes left just to say.
Great. Thanks so much. So the community hubs, they're piloting Help Me Connect, but we also are expanding mental health consultation, Bridge to Benefits as a screener to figure out what folks are eligible for, and then also, again, learning communities. Our data portal work, we know that the technology is one part of the solution, but we also want to be making sure that we're aligning eligibility and service coordination and the legal processes to make sure that we can coordinate across agencies. So this will also include a common application and that back-end technology support. Another activity is our early childhood workforce, and so we'll be embedding our knowledge and competency framework additions into our work, and then also advancing transforming the early childhood workforce recommendations, and also overall recommendations on how the state's supporting the early childhood business model. We do have additional activities of the grant, and so one is how are we supporting family, friend, and neighbor providers? So we'll have a learning community and, again, expanding mental health consultation. We'll also be expanding mental health consultation to cross-sector local reflective practice teams and creating a trauma and healing informed toolkit. The final of these additional activities is supporting those transitions from early childhood to kindergarten. I won't go into any detail on this slide, but just to say that the preschool development grant is a part of a multi-state learning collaborative for the federal government as well. And so we are getting significant federal technical assistance and are a part of several learning communities with other states so that we can lift up their best practices and then have a way to share back our learnings with the federal government. And then my final slide is really how we're bringing it all together. I went into detail about various activities as a part of the grant, but there's this overall work that's happening that will be required to update our comprehensive needs assessment and our strategic plan by 2022. We're also working on a sustainability plan by the end of this calendar year so that we have a full year to be considering implementation. And then we know that community engagement is critical within each of these activities, but then the overall grant. We want to make sure that as we're implementing this work, that it's done as informed by community so that we make sure we're creating solutions to the right challenges. We also have a strong tribal nations focus. And so we have a tribal nations lead that's hired as a part of the grant. And there's also work to have an Indigenous evaluation as a part of this work. And of course, an overall evaluation as well. And again, the overall goal of this grant is really how are we taking these guiding principles and how do we have inclusive and responsive practices, programs, and policies for children and families? So that concludes my remarks, and I'm happy to take questions now or at a later time.
Ms. Varley, thank you so much, and thank you for this really important work. We really appreciate it. And members, I know that once again, first of all, to the staff who presented, thank you so much for condensing so much information in such a short amount of time. As with the other presentations, what we really can get is at least an introduction to the issues. And then to my mind, the slides that we have received are a really rich resource. We wanna make sure to use those. I wanna make sure to note for folks that the needs assessment and the strategic plan that Ms. Varley referenced are hyperlinked in the presentation, and that's true for members of the public as well. You can just find it right on our website. You can click the link and you can read that yourself. And I also wanted to note too that there's a reference to the transforming the early childhood workforce in that slide. And I think the person leading that work is Krista Anders, who presented to our committee a couple weeks ago, just to try to make some connections. And we have a couple minutes for quick questions and then more time at the end. Anybody have a kind of clarifying question or something they want to ask now before we get into the budget presentations? Let's give a minute here, see if there are any hands raised. Yes, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps this will come up, so if it is, you could wait on the question, but thank you to our presenter. I'm just wondering if this program will serve new children, or will it primarily serve the children that are already on the rolls? Is it going to expand to other children, in other words? Thanks.
Ms. Varley, if you're the right person, yep.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Chair and Representative Bennett, for the question. So it's a bit of a misnomer that it's a grant that goes to the state. So then we do have sub-grants that go out in, as a part of the preschool development grant. So those are the community solutions grants as well as the hubs. And so presumably, and then also working with family, friend, and neighbor providers. So we will be reaching, we assume, children who we have not reached in the past throughout this work, but really it is a systems building grant. And so it isn't increasing necessarily access to programs or increasing the ability, like the number of children that existing programs can serve in itself.
Representative Bennett's follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, your kind of expanding programs for current children, but not necessarily expanding the additional number of children. Is that correct?
Ms. Varley.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and Representative Bennett. It's increasing the number of children who are supported. It's more supporting programs in reaching children, but not increasing the number of children served, if that
If I could try, Ms. Varley, just quick, it's more of a coordination of existing programs than an expansion than a program itself. It's more a way to have existing programs work better together. Is that, Ms. Varley, am I saying that right?
Correct. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Yeah, thank Representative you. Bennett, follow? Okay.
That's good. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. And other questions? I just have one clarification I want to get from Ms. Hoganson, just for the benefit of everybody, which is the Children's Cabinet, although early childhood is one component of the work, the Children's Cabinet under the administration really covers and is trying to support children all the way up, I think even to in their early 20s, but certainly going all the way through. Is that, can you just clarify that for us? Make sure we kind of understand the connection with our jurisdiction.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Children's Cabinet is supposed to cover really prenatal into, sometimes we say prefrontal cortex development, so early adulthood. And I did forget to flag in our State Advisory Council, Representative Juergens and Chair Pinto serve on that council. And so I appreciate your knowledge and background and experience with our work, but that is the purview of the Children's Cabinet.
It's helpful. I love the prefrontal cortex development, the brain science, putting that front and center. Thank you. Okay, not seeing other questions right now. So we're going to turn then to the budget presentations. I want to highlight for members, language, as you're aware, has been kind of slow. The revisor's office has been really burdened. And so we will have a portion of this in language in front of us this morning relating to a proposal for summer preschool for children. We're going to get to that. But otherwise, we won't have the language, but I really want to encourage members to please dive in and ask questions. When the language is in front of us at a later date, our time may be pretty tight and limited. This is the chance we've got presenters to make sure we really understand the presentations. And so with that, I think that Ms. Burnham is our first up. And if you can identify yourself and proceed, I believe that the The material for the Department of Education proposals are in House File 1065 and Article 7. So though the language is not in front of us officially, and again, we will have it later, if that's something folks want to look up, HF 1065, Article 7, I think will direct you to that area. So Ms. Burnham, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Good morning, committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner of the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Department of Ed. My previous role was Director of Early Learning Services, so early learning remains very, very, very close to my heart. So happy to be with you this morning. I'm going to briefly go over the governor's 2021 budget proposals related to early childhood. The budget proposals include a summer package, maintaining the VPK seats, proposal around supporting our American Indian early learners, and a few technical items. The first of the summer package proposals is really supporting our partners out in the community around school-based, school-age childcare and youth programming. We know that we need to continue to support schools as they navigate the pandemic while prioritizing in-person learning for as many students as possible. We're looking to enhance and expand academic as well as social emotional learning opportunities and mental health services and support our younger students through the summer. This proposal allocates GEAR funds to address areas of need in school age care and youth programming. The funds will be used to support before, after summer school, youth wraparound programming, as well as access to high quality services and supports. So we've divided this $15.947 million into three buckets. The first bucket will go to supporting school age care staffing and administration. The next bucket will access to increase before, after, and summer school wraparound services. And the last bucket will go to trying to address our early learning scholarship wait list to the extent possible. And other money included in this summer package is $1 million for the Minnesota Service Co-ops. The Service Co-ops have been very fundamental to our efforts and of our regional support teams comprised of staff from MDE, Department of Health, local public health agencies. These teams have been really the backbone of the support for the Minnesota school districts and charter schools as they've been transitioning from one learning model to the next based on our safe learning plan. So for the past 10 months, the co-ops have provided one FTE per site and really at no charge. So we're looking to really support their continued efforts. The next piece of our summer package is to expand preschool for 4 and 5 year olds during the summer. This is targeted at free and reduced price lunch children. And the program and the children need to meet at least one of the following eligibility categories, including foster care, child protection, those experiencing homelessness, or children of teenage parents. And children who fall under multiple categories would have the highest priority. Any remaining seats, then families can participate at a sliding fee scale. So what we did is figured out the average rate of cost for childcare, and we are looking for the 4 and 5 year olds who have not enrolled in kindergarten yet, filling that void of some of those 4 and 5 year olds who may have chosen to not attend kindergarten due to COVID. We're targeting the most underserved, and we're really looking at these programs to offer a minimum of 6 instructional hours a day for 5 days a week for up to 10 to 12 weeks. The intent is that all settings that are 3 and 4 star rated that serve preschool age children, including school-based, Head Start, all licensed settings, including child care centers and family child care, where preschool children can experience high quality summer learning experience. And we're really looking at leveraging existing systems to distribute the funds through MDE as far as distribution of funds like school readiness, Head Start, and avenues we've used for other GEAR funds for non-public programs, such as a grant program. The next piece of the governor's early learning package is, of course, to maintain the 4,000 VPK and School Readiness Plus seats that are set to expire in fiscal year 22. And then we're adding a requirement for the kindergarten entry profile to be administered to all VPK in School Readiness Plus students. So for the fiscal year 21, we know that the statewide cap on participation in for VPK and SRP was 7,160 students. This was 10.9% of our four-year-olds. The cap is set to eliminate 4,000 of these seats, thereby reducing the program to only 3,160 seats, which is only about 4.8% of our four-year-olds. The next piece of our package is to really support our American Indian early learners. We've had multiple and ongoing conversations with our tribal nation partners, and they've identified three areas that are in high need and would appreciate additional support with, and those are the areas of family engagement, increased language and literacy outcomes through language revitalization programs, and supporting the enhancement of teaching practices and efforts to support teacher diversity in continuing education. As you know, we've had conversations in the past around the tribal Head Start programs. We have proposed that we designate 10.72% of the total Head Start annual allocation to be a fixed allocation to the tribal programs. This will alleviate the fluctuation in funding due to the fluctuation in the federal funding formula. So we know that the tribes, as well as other Head Start programs, really need to know how much they're going to get on a year-to-year basis. And over the past several years, the tribal programs have actually decreased in the state amount of funding due to the, how the federal funding formula works. So we're really working to support our tribal programs with a designated set aside of 10.72%. A few other early learning proposals that are more on the technical side is to reduce the number of months for early learning scholarships to select a program from 10 to 3 months. We're looking for this to solve two main issues. The underuse of the scholarship by a child awarded a scholarship, and promoting the child receiving the quality early learning experience earlier rather than losing months of that opportunity. We're also looking to, with our VPK programs, equalize the participation of early childhood special ed services and English language learners. And then provide an equitable breakfast reimbursement consistent with all voluntary pre-K and school readiness children. And then ensure the membership hours for kindergarten students with a disability are the same as the average daily membership calculation for other kindergarten students as well. And those are quickly the early learning proposals included in this year's governor's budget.
Ms. Burnham, thank you for going through those members. I'm inclined to take a couple minutes on those. We're going to be hearing from MDH and DHS. I think it may be easier just sort of mentally for us to do that. So I encourage members to ask questions. I'll just start with just noting a couple things. The proposal regarding the summer preschool is on our website and sent to members in the form of, it says the DE1 to House File 5. And so we do have that language in front of us. That was what I referenced before. And so we actually have had that language. I guess I do want to clarify with Ms. Burnham that in addition to that summer piece, you also referenced the summer package. Maybe we could even bring that slide back up if we can. there was a note about funding going to early learning scholarships. And I just want to clarify, because it seems like the other pieces would not be in our committee's jurisdiction. I just make sure that we're clear about exactly. This would be slide 24, I guess, under school age care and programming. There's a reference to access to high quality childcare services and supports. Ms. Burnham, can you just clarify, is that phrase referencing that final bullet there, the 6.473 million to the early learning scholarship waitlist?
Yes, so that package, the 15.947, includes three different buckets of money. 6.473 will go toward addressing the early learning scholarship waitlist. And then 6.473 will go to support school age care staffing and administration. So the piece around that is really looking at how to support our certified programs, our community ed programs who offer school age childcare. And then the 3 million will be a continuation of the GEAR money, or we are going to distribute it similar to how we did the 0-8 grants for wraparound services with the last round of GEAR monies.
And Ms. Burnham, is the so this is all federal funding. It looks like no state money on this slide, I guess, versus that, correct?
Correct.
And is legislative authorization needed for this, or is this funding that I believe with GEAR funding, it's ultimately it's money provided by the federal government and up to the administration's discretion. Is that correct?
I believe so, but I'm gonna phone a friend and have Stephanie Hokanson
Yeah, Ms. Hogan, if you can, I noticed this is part of the budget proposals, and so I thought perhaps it's, I guess I'm not quite sure. So Ms. Hogan, if you can comment if you're on.
Mr. Chair, it was specifically to the 6.473 million?
That's the piece in our jurisdiction, I guess, if it's different than the full 15.947 million. Yeah, if you could just clarify that for us.
No, it's leveraging that 15.947 million of GEAR federal funding that was part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021 that the federal government passed at the end of December. So a portion of that would be used to serve children currently on the waiting list for early learning scholarships. So first, of course, it would go to the children in the priority categories and then would fund children not in the priority categories that are on the wait list.
And I guess my question, Ms. Hogan, is, so does this go through the, does it need to go through the legislative budget process and receive legislative approval, or is it something where the administration has discretion under the terms by which the federal government provided the funds?
Mr. Chair, sorry about that. Yes, it does need to go be approved by the Legislative Advisory Commission.
But Legislative Advisory Commission, but not necessarily needs to go through our budget process in order to be allocated, correct?
Mr. Chair, correct. It needs to be approved by the Legislative Advisory Commission, so that separate process.
Okay, good. I'm just sort of clarifying whether it needed to, would be something that we would have to necessarily act on as a committee, and it sounds like the answer is no, because it would go through the Legislative Advisory Commission, correct?
Mr. Chair, correct.
All right, thank you. Representative Katiza Witun has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Burnham or potentially Ms. Hogan, I'm curious, what do you have an idea of what the early, after this $6+ million allocation, do you have an idea of what the early learning scholarship waitlist looks like above and beyond that?
And Ms. Burnham,
we may need to look into some state funding to potentially eliminate that waitlist.
Ms. Burnham, you can shed some light on that.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Representative, we do have those numbers, and I know that we just recently have updated those waitlist numbers, so we would be happy to get those to you, and I will be in touch with Sandy Myers to get those to you in the committee.
Ms. Burnham, please do that. It looks like you're all done, Representative Katiza Witun. Okay, Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if anyone can provide more detail on that chunk of money, the first chunk of money, that 6 point some million that's going towards supporting school age care. Just wondering if there's more detail about how that money is going to be used. I know that our school districts are really sort of missing a lot of money from providing free care for tier one workers. So I don't know if that's part of that or if someone could provide more details if you know more about how that money might be spent.
And so it's a bit outside of our jurisdiction, but given that we have Ms. Burnham in front of us, let's at least get an answer to that. So Ms. Burnham.
Sure. Chair Pinto, Representative, that was exactly part of the intent for this particular bucket of money is we work closely with our community ed partners and have heard over the last 10 months to 11 months how impactful this has been on their community ed programs. So in an effort to help support those programs, this is a piece of that particular bucket of money.
Okay, Representative Tisa, I'm sorry, Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a great answer, so thank you.
Good. And I want to note Representative Heather Keeler is on with us. She's not an official member of the committee, but has a great interest in these issues and has joined for a couple of hearings. And so just welcome, glad to have you with us. Other questions, members, that you may have? I don't see any. And I'll note again that the language regarding summer preschool is in front of us in the form of that DE1 amendment. So folks can take a look at that. But we'll move on to the next our next presenter. Ms. Manning or Commissioner Manning, if you can please identify yourself and then proceed.
Good morning. I'm Mary Manning, Assistant Commissioner for the Health Improvement Bureau of the Minnesota Department of Health.
So, Manning, just a little bit of difficulty hearing you. I don't know if that's true for other folks as well. Yeah, if you can sort of make sure you get nice and close to your mic.
All right. Thank you. Okay, is this better? Leaning in? Okay,
thank you. Yeah.
All right, thanks. With this first slide, this first slide is just highlighting, although that's not the first one. The first slide should be titled Child and Family Health.
Oops. First.
Oh.
Fetal and Infant Mortality Review is the one that I'm seeing.
Okay, well. It's not my first one, but we'll go to this one. The Infant Mortality Review, the statute that allowed for Infant Mortality Review sunset in 2001. The Infant Mortality Review process is a well-established continuous improvement methodology developed by the National Fetal and Infant Mortality Review, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Maternal and Child Health Bureau. And the infant mortality review process is the best way for us to understand and ultimately address the factors that contribute to stillbirths and infant deaths that occur before a child's first birthday. The review that we're proposing here to continue on to reinstate would include all births, all deaths that occur after 20 weeks gestation and any deaths that occur before a child's first birthday. The community action teams that are referenced on this slide are an important component of the fetal mortality review process. The community works with us to identify solutions from the work that we find, and we use those solutions in action. Maternal mortality death studies. Currently, we do maternal mortality, but with so few deaths, 25 to 30 a year, I know that's a lot of deaths, but it's hard to get a full picture of what contributes for birth outcomes with that. Adding morbidity to the review process will give us a better understanding of the context of what contributes to poor outcomes. The definition of severe mortality morbidity from the CDC would include any unexpected outcome of labor and delivery that results in short-term or long-term consequences. Again, the Community Action Committee that's a part of this review process provides us with good identifying good solutions that we can work with. next legislative thing is right-sizing the family home grouping. Legislation passed in 2015 that provided grants to implement family partnerships.
Commissioner Manning, we're having a really hard time understanding you. My apologies to members. You're really going in and out. I was sort of thinking that it was working, but it's pretty challenging. Oh. Yeah. I'm not sure if there's better connection we can get. It was kind of you were really coming in and then kind of dropping out pretty sharply.
I can try leaning in further. Is this better?
Yeah, let's give that a try. Just get real.
Okay, it looks pretty weird. Real close. Okay.
Yeah, well, you can. Yes, no problem. It's just fine. Yeah, if you get nice and close to the mic, I think that should help. We'll try it.
All right. Nurse family partnership is the gold standard of evidence-based family home visiting. Home visits are provided by a nurse. And only community health boards and tribes are eligible to apply for the funding. Since the first round of funding, we have not had any additional sites implement the Nurse Family Partnership. Although some have applied for expanding some funding. Currently, we have 5 grantees. In 2017, by statute, Medicaid raised their reimbursement rates for nurse home visits. And ultimately, the health plans followed suit and increased their reimbursement as well. Since this increase in reimbursement for nurse home visits, the 5 family partnership grantees have generally underspent their funds. Thus, this reduction is more of a right-sizing and is reflective of underspending by grantees that have occurred over the past few years. Additionally, in 2017, the legislature passed state evidence-based home visiting funding, which allowed for nonprofits, along with community health boards and tribes, to apply for funding to support implementation of several other home visiting models. The communities can choose a model that works best for their community. Many of these models offered greater flexibility in who provided the home visiting, which included possibly an early childhood educator or a social worker or a community health worker. It also offered flexibility in when the home visit starts. While we encourage visits to start prenatally, they could also start during the postpartum period. They also had flexibility and were able to include more people in those visits, the father and other family members. And there were no limits about the number of children the woman could have had. It wouldn't have to have been her first pregnancy. Within Minnesota, at the present time, there is no nonprofit that uses nurse visits as home visits. But we do know that we get very good outcomes using the nurse home visits. But most home visits in Minnesota that are in are using home nurses, the nurses are white. So we do like the mixture that we have. I think I'll go now to the next slide, right-sizing the home, the fetal alcohol syndrome. Since Governor Carlson's administration, under the leadership of First Lady Susan Carlson, Minnesota has invested in this persistent but preventable public health issue. Under bipartisan leadership, this investment has grown to $2 million in appropriation, which has been awarded to Proof Alliance, formerly known as MOFAS. Historically, Proof Alliance has worked in prevention with MDH. Historically, Proof Alliance has worked in prevention for providing early identification and support for families of individuals with fetal alcohol syndrome. And they do excellent work. They're vital partners for preventing and mitigating the physical, mental, and behavioral implications of fetal alcohol syndrome. So this isn't a matter of the work that they're doing. We think they're doing excellent work.
Just a reminder, if you can, to make sure to stay close and speak up.
Okay.
Thanks.
Since 2015, Proof Alliance has underspent their grant somewhere between $175,000 to $500,000. So this is more of a right sizing than it is a cut. So we were looking at, you know, reductions where we wouldn't be reducing the services. That concludes my
comment. Thank you very much. And I'd ask members if you want Assistant Commissioner Manning to go back to any of those early slides to hear anything better. I think we caught most of it, but still speak up if you do. And I will note that the copy of the slides that's posted on our website seems to be missing a lot of the content of your slides, Assistant Commissioner. Maybe somebody can just take a look at that and give us, we were able to see them on the screen. They just didn't appear on the posted version. So if we can hopefully get that to complete our records, that'd be great. Just looking to see if folks have questions for Assistant Commissioner. I just want to clarify one thing. You referenced the home visiting grants for Nurse Family Partnership. And I believe that there is a separate fund for home visiting grants as well. So there's sort of two different funds within MDH. Can you clarify that? Or perhaps our staff, Mr. Berg, is aware of that, but I'll look to you, Assistant Commissioner Manning, first.
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay, two different funds. Do you happen to know, or perhaps Mr. Berg knows, the amount in each of those funds, just for our purposes, so we can just understand home visiting a little bit better?
I do not.
Okay.
I can get back to the committee with that.
I think Mr. Berg might have it. I would be surprised if he does.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that off the top of my head. I can send that to you later on what the MDH portion of home visiting is.
That'd be great. Thank you.
I don't know anything about the Department of Ed's side of it.
Yes, and a reminder to members that in fact that MDE has home visiting programs as well, and MDH. As well. So thank you, Mr. Berg. Looking to see any other questions, not seeing any. And so thank you so much. And let's bring up Commissioner Bailey, if we can, and identify yourself for the record. I just want to note to members that I believe Commissioner Bailey is going to be talking about recommendations that are contained in House File 1040. It's Articles 1 and 5 contain some of the provisions that she'll be talking about, just to kind of orient everybody. But, Commissioner, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm Lisa Bailey. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. I want to thank you for your time today, allowing us to discuss the Child Care Assistance Program and to put forward this important piece of the governor's budget proposal. Next slide, please. The Child Care Assistance Program helps pay for child care while parents go to work or school, while ensuring that the children are well cared for and that they're prepared then to enter school. In state fiscal year 2020, CCAP served 30,000 children across the state, and that's approximately 15,000 families. We know that 60% of the children who were served were age 5 or younger, and about 40% were ages 6 to 13. Next slide, please. The Child Care Assistance Program can reduce impacts of social and economic inequities. And how do we do that? Well, by helping families and children receive CCAP in order to have access to employment and educational opportunities while the children are being cared for, to increase access to that safe, affordable, quality care so that children are, while they're being well cared for, and their learning opportunities are supported to get them ready for school, to support providers who serve families receiving CCAP by ensuring that they receive payment comparable to what they would receive from private pay families. This is especially important during this COVID time. The chart on this slide shows the race and ethnicity of children served by CCAP in 2020. And the reason why this is important is that this tracks with the reality that Minnesota's American Indian and African American families face significant disparities with regard to income and poverty, as well as some of the worst achievement gaps in the nation. And to help narrow those disparities, children of color must have access to quality early learning opportunities that can improve their school readiness. So there's some federal compliance efforts that we made progress back in 2020. During the 2020 legislative session, the legislature passed a rate increase updating CCAP maximum rates, that's the most that can be paid, to pay at the 25th percentile of the 2018 market rate survey. Those rate increases went into effect in September of 2020, which was the first increase to CCAP rates in 6 years. The chart on this slide shows the percent of providers' prices that are fully covered by CCAP maximum rates. The progress made in 2020 allowed CCAP to cover more access to the market, but the 25th percentile, well, I should say the 25th percentile means that when the market rate survey data is stacked lowest to highest, the prices for the bottom 1/4 of the prices reported are fully covered. So we do a statewide survey of the market and then set the price based on that survey. To achieve minimum federal compliance, the maximum rates were set to the 25th percentile, which allowed Minnesota to reach temporary compliance by providing the lowest level of equal access to the market allowed. That was based on the 2018 market rate survey. On the next slide, then, we'll talk more about what equal access means. So the federal law requires that states must certify that our payment rates are sufficient to ensure equal access for eligible children in a way that is comparable to services provided for children who aren't eligible, and that it's based on data collected in surveys conducted every 3 years. So what is equal access? Well, the federally recommended benchmark to ensure equal access is to set rates at the 75th percentile which is an amount that says at least 3/4 of the provider prices are fully covered by those maximum rates. Minnesota's maximum rates were last set at the 75th percentile back in 2002. Our current rates, which are now at the 25th percentile last year, is the lowest measure of access allowed. Minnesota avoided some penalties and sanctions by meeting that point in time benchmark. We had received a penalty letter from the federal government giving us until last fall to comply. And we did come into compliance with that, but that is temporary. Where does the 25th percentile come from? We've had a lot of questions about that. Basically, the federal government has accepted the 25th percentile as the minimum rate that states may use. We have had a letter from the Administration for Children and Families indicating that the 25th percentile is sufficient for now, but they will not be sufficient for compliance in the future. We don't know when that would be. The Office of Child Care expects the payment rates to continue to move up in the future. Before we had met that minimum floor in 2020, we were placed on a corrective action plan with notice of potential forfeiture of funds received back in 2019 if the minimum percentile was not met. And then that at that time was sufficient. They had determined that our rates were insufficient to ensure equal access. Without another increase to at least the 25th percentile tied to the new survey, which will be done this year, we expect to be subject to penalties. Next slide, please. So that's the federal law. Minnesota state law, our statutes direct the Department of Human Services to conduct this market rate survey every 3 years, and at the moment restricts the rates to the 25th percentile using the 2018 data, our last data. And the statute specifically, as they're cited here, gives us, is now every 3 years to determine that 75th percentile for I don't know what that means, like care arrangements in county price culture. So that's how the survey is done. And again, the survey is currently underway for 2021. And then the other statute that's cited up here has the subsidy restrictions, and it states what those maximum rates should be. Next slide, please. So the governor's proposal is to increase the rates to the 30th percentile of the most recent market rate survey. We anticipate that that will result in increases in 2022 and 2025, which would be the next one. And that is that would keep us in compliance with updating, so giving us to a new market rate survey, and it would prepare for a potential increase in the threshold to get us to what we believe will be minimum compliance. So the cost of that is 47.5 million in the first biennium and 85.2 million in the second biennium. This is important. This cost, it would be paid for through the federal block grant. There would be a small, what we would think is small, relatively speaking, systems update cost would be requested from the general fund, and that would be $12,000 for us to make some adjustments to the system. I do just want to make a note about why 30th percentile. We've had some questions about that. We slightly increasing those CCAP rates increases access for the children and families who rely on those rates, and it gets them they have more opportunity for more providers who would be willing to accept those rates, and it keeps the financial burden to families as low as possible. Next slide, please. So what are the benefits? Again, reduces the family's out-of-pocket expenses, increases providers' willingness to accept families receiving CCAP. We know based on recent surveys of providers that we've done across the state that most providers who charge some additional costs to the additional fees to the families, some providers just are not able to accept that amount at all. And it improves the likelihood that CCAP families can find a provider who meets their needs, either in their area or their timing needs. And it helps providers then improve the quality of their services. And of course, finally, it avoids the risk of financial penalties applicable to these funds. Next slide. So other states, we had some questions about this. 22 states had all their payment rates above the 25th percentile. And you, as you can see, our neighbors, Iowa is up in the 75th percentile of the 2017 rates, North Dakota and South Dakota as well. Eight states have actually set their payment rates at the 25th percentile, just to give you some comparison points. Next slide, please. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide. This just shows that this is sort of the intersection of the quality differentials and the for parent aware and how different programs are ranked or rated, and shows that these differentials pay for different percentages depending on where those are located across the state and what kind of facility they are. I think we provided some written explanation of the slide, and I'm not an expert on this one, so if we have questions, we're happy to answer them. I have Lori Placine here as well. But that takes us to the end of this presentation. I just am open for any questions.
Actually, let's go, Ms. Bailey, let's go back one slide, just as long as you have that up, to make sure the folks, because you're correct. There was a question at a previous hearing about why it would be that there'd be a given, just to remind everyone, the rates increase, this the 20% differential, it's actually a there's a higher payment depending on the quality of care. It sounds like, Ms. Bailey, that Ms. Posine is available to answer. And I just wanted to make sure that people are aware that the information, a response was sent out to the committee on February, in response to our February 4th hearing. But Ms. Posine, perhaps you could just clarify, as long as we have you, for folks who may not have received that, about what the confusion is here and just to clear it up. If you understand what I'm asking.
Good morning. This is Lori Posing with the Department of Human Services Child Care Assistance Program. And yes, Chair Pinto and members of the committee, we sent some follow-up. What it's really intended to share, and there's just maybe too many graphs on here to cause some confusion, but what we wanted to show was that when there are differentials applied to the rates for providers who fall in these categories of those that qualify for the 15% differential and those that fall in the 28% differential category, that the differential makes a difference. For more providers in those groups, they proportionately have more of their rates covered. And it just so happens that in some cases, for instance, those that have the 15% differential applied have more of the rates they charge covered. It doesn't mean their rates are more. It means, and that the CCAP payment covers more. It means that by groups of providers, that group gets more of their rates covered.
And thank you, Ms. Posehn. And again, for members, there was an explanation sent out about this, but there was a question, I think I may have asked it at the, we had our CCAP overview hearing, and I want to make sure to at least direct your attention to that. And thank you, Ms. Posehn, and thank you, Commissioner Bailey, for going back to that. Let's bring the back to our grid of folks then, and we'll move to questions. I want to note that we did have corrected slides that have been both sent to members and also posted to our committee website. So those should now be able to be read by folks. And so Representative Wasilewicz, I think you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a couple of questions. I did note in one of the slides that the federal funds from the CCDBG grant are covering those rate proposed rate increases. I'm wondering if Ms. Bailey, and maybe this is a question for you, if that's always the case. So if we decided as a state we wanted to go to the 75th percentile, for example, would that be something that we would receive additional federal money for, or would that be something that the state would have to kick in funds to cover?
Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Representative, that is an excellent question. And the answer is that we can't know that at this point. It's part of the reason why I think there's been hesitancy to set a rate going forward forever, because the amount of funds that we receive from the federal government, we would usually have some indication, I think, going forward several years. And I can get some clarification on that. But no, we would not be able to know in advance that we would have all of the ability to cover all the funds set at this point in the future using those block grant funds. We know that what we have right now would cover this request. And I can get an answer back for you to know how far in advance we know that. Certainly we know that it would cover for the biennium and I believe the second biennium without any additional state funds.
So Wasilewicz, follow up?
Yeah, that's very helpful. The other question I had, I don't know if this is available here or not, but was around sort of, you had mentioned that back in 2002, we had rates set at that 75th percentile, and we've sort of seen them go down and down and down over the years. And I'm wondering if you have any sense for the differences in like numbers of providers or percentages of providers, whether child care centers or family child care that accepted CCAP, when the rates were higher versus when the rates are lower now. I don't know if you can speak to that at all.
Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm going to ask Lori Posehn if she could step in. She's the expert on this. I do know we've seen a lot of change in the industry over the last 18 years, and so that may account for it.
Ms. Posehn.
Good morning. Again, yes, Representative Chair Pinto and members, we did send some data, I'm just looking at it, showing some historical data, but only dated back to 2017. So I would have to go back and see if we have prior data, comparable data, but essentially it is true that provider participation in CCAP has gone down even since 2017. So in answer to your question, we'll have to get back to you with any data over time.
Representative Wasilewicz, follow-up?
Just one quick follow-up. I don't know if Ms. Posehn or someone else can answer this, but do we have, I know there's been a number of surveys done with providers. Do we have a sense, I don't know if anything around CCAP specifically has been done. I'm just wondering if we have a sense of why providers have maybe not been as willing to take CCAP, if it's been a paperwork issue, if it's been a rates issue, if we have a sense of that or any data to provide to back up why that might be the case beyond the rates issue that we've seen.
Ms. Posehn, perhaps, or maybe Commissioner Bailey. Ms. Posehn?
Yes, I'll take it. We did do a survey in 2018, and we would be glad to provide some of those results to you. But I will note it has both some numerical and some anecdotal or narrative statements about paperwork rates and waiting for payments versus families who in the private market typically pay at the beginning of the week and CCAP pays up to 21 days after. So there's payment policies, there's payment rates, and then there's the actual lift of doing the paperwork and you know, doing more than a provider would have to do if they're being paid in the private market, extra things that are associated with CCAP. So we will provide you with a summary of that survey.
Mr. Chair.
Who is that? Sorry. Oh, yeah, Commissioner Bailey, pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just like to support that, what Lori is saying, that we, in that survey, half the providers responded, said that the rates are a barrier to even accepting CCAP recipients at all. So just want to, and we'll get you more information about the additional thing, but I think that's a really important thing to point out.
The low rate certainly couldn't help, that's for sure. Okay, good. Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. And Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, towards the beginning of the presentation, you spoke about the numbers of families who are being served by CCAP. I'm wondering if we know the percentage of eligible families that we are serving to sort of determine who, you know, how many folks are eligible that are not part of this program.
Ms. Poseen, perhaps.
Representative Chair Pinto, members, I think what you might be asking is that how many families don't access the program? The families receiving it are eligible income-wise and activities. So the best information I can give right now is that in December, we just got the December waiting list. There was just over 2,000 families waiting who believe they are eligible for the program. They're sort of pre-screened by the counties and tribes. And so that's a 2,000 figure. There are likely more eligible families than that in the state of Minnesota. Those are just families who've reached out and asked.
Bolden, looks like you've nothing further. Okay, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually now that question came up. Thank you, Representative Bolden. So 2,000 families are on the waiting list. And when they're on the waiting list because they haven't been processed yet or they haven't been able to find a childcare situation that would accept their CCAP payments, if we maybe just a little bit more clarification on that, Mr. Chair, and then I do have another question.
Ms. Poseen, I think probably directed you.
Thank you, Representative and Chair members. Yes, we 2,000 families roughly, meaning that they the counties had determined in December that there wasn't enough funds to serve them. So it's not so much that they're waiting for a provider, although that can happen as well. Even for families who get approved on the financial side, sometimes it takes weeks or even longer to find a provider that will accept CCAP or who has an opening. Mm-hmm. But no, the 2,000 number is literally, we can't serve you yet because we don't have funds.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Ms. Poseen. Then I also, I think I want to go back to Ms. Bailey's, Commissioner Bailey's presentation. And just to make sure that I understand it fully and highlight it, but right now we are temporarily in compliance with the federal block grant. And so what I take that to mean is that the legislature does not take further action, we will again be out of compliance. And Mr. Chair, if I am correct on thinking that way.
Ms. Poseen or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair. Representative Pryor then and members, that is correct. That was a temporary by tying when the 2020 legislature tied that change to the most recent market rate survey, as long as we didn't do another market rate survey, we were in compliance. But now, because by law we have to do a market rate survey every 3 years, we're doing another one this year. Unless it falls at exactly the same amount, we will be out of compliance. And again, the 25th percentile is based on the guidance that we've received. It's been indicated to us that will not be sufficient going forward. We don't have a definitive date or anything like that.
I'd like to, Representative Franson, and then I do want to make sure we talked about the summer preschool proposal. Representative Franson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aren't we getting some more federal funds tied to COVID relief for childcare?
Commissioner Bailey, can you talk about that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, that's correct. We do have funds that are coming into the state from the federal government. I believe the total amount is $135 million, I think. Some of that has already been allocated for funds to providers during this COVID period. The remainder is being, we're discussing that now about how to do that, how to allocate those funds. Those would go towards potentially, well, there are several different options, but potentially towards some of the providing the funds to the county so that they could have some of the people who are on waiting lists, or providing more funds for the basic sliding fee families who would receive funds from that. So that's correct.
Please finish, Commissioner.
And that would be those funds due to the significant or the many providers that we have, that those funds, the way we're looking at it, it would help us through this COVID period, and they would need to be tied specifically to the COVID response. I don't think that those need to be, I don't believe that those can be used for the maximum rates, to increase the maximum rates. And I can check into that, but I think it needs to be specifically tied to the COVID response.
Yeah, and Representative Franson.
Yeah, so I would, and I think Mr. Chair too, you and I should look into that as well. I would like us to have more of a robust conversation on where those funds should be spent, instead of the department having carte blanche over the spending, to have some sort of oversight on that as well.
Thank you, Representative Franson. And I should note, the department has had some, I know there was a discussion with a number of legislators. I think there may be even one that may be scheduled for later today, and we should connect on that, Representative Franson, make sure that that's on your calendar, and regarding those, because absolutely want to make sure they're providing that input. Representative Franson.
That's it, Mr. Chair. If I could give one more thing, just
please, of course.
Helpful yep. thing. One yep. thing that during this time I really would like to see is if we could put some sort of a letter together to Congress regarding the food program. It's something that we don't have much to say about, but during this time, I really don't think that we should be having two tiers, level one, level two, for funding for these for the food program, and to see everybody on a level one. Food prices are going up, and providers are struggling, and food is you know, if you're on a level two for funding, it's pennies. Like, what's the point of even being on the food program? So, just my two cents.
No, thank you, Representative Franson. That's actually really nice. Commissioner, yeah, if you're in.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Franson. I just wanted to, back to your previous point, emphasize that we welcome your attendance. I believe it's this evening that we're getting together with some of the legislators. We have already done one presentation, and we've had over the last several weeks engagement efforts with outside stakeholders, with providers and families, looking into that. So we'd be really welcome your participation and input on that. And I hope if I misstated something earlier, I hope I was saying it correctly about what those funds could be used for, but we can correct all that at this evening's meeting.
Yep, and please, and yeah, and then follow up will send to the broader committee as well. This is a nice transition because we'd introduced House File 5 intended to be directed to COVID relief, and then actually the federal funding came in, which is good. So we've had support. We discussed that in our very first committee hearing, members may remember, as a committee in mid-January, I guess it was. But a portion of the governor's budget relates to an area that really can't wait until after July 1st or when we would approve in later in May, which is that summer preschool funding. And so what I want to do is just get the language in front of us now. This is maybe just a little bit silly because we're not going to be taking any action, but I want to make sure we at least have the language in front. And the what I'm planning to do is to do that as a DE amendment to House File 5. And so I'm going to hand the gavel to Representative Pryor, the Vice Chair. And again, this is really just to get that language in front of us. You can find it, members of the public, and the DE language on our website. So Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So committee members, our next item on the agenda is House File 5. Chair Pinto, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 5 to be placed before the committee.
Okay. House File 5 is now before the committee. Chair Pinto, I understand you have an amendment, and would you like to present it?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And so this is the DE1 amendment. And again, members, for clarification, this is really just to put the language in front of us. I do plan to then withdraw the amendment. We'll be laying the bill over for further discussion. But this contains the language for the proposal that Ms. Burnham talked about from the Department of Education relating to summer preschool. You've already heard content about it, so I think this is just a chance for us to ask any questions. I do want to note that there's a letter from McPinn, which is a child care provider information network that's been posted to the website, so I want to make sure to see that commentary. I guess one clarification that I want to both make, but then have, I guess as the author of the amendment, but then have Ms. Burnham or somebody clarify, is there was some concern expressed that this would only apply to the summer preschool, the school age settings. And when I review the language of the proposal, it could be used in a variety of settings. And so if Ms. Burnham is still on, or if it'd be somebody else who could simply clarify regarding that proposal. And again, to remind members, the reason we're doing this now in particular is because this really probably couldn't wait during our regular budget process. And so we want to make sure that it's teed up in case we are able to take action on it. But maybe with your permission, Madam Chair, somebody from MDE could comment on that question.
All right. And let me see.
Ms. Burnham, hopefully. Oh, I see her there.
Who's go? Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner for MDE. Representative Pinto. You're referring to the summer preschool for 4 and 5 year olds, the $20 million proposal. That is intended to serve all program types, including school-based, Head Start, licensed settings, including child care centers and family child care, where preschool children can experience a high quality early learning experience.
Great. Chair Pinto, Representative Pinto, you can continue with your presentation.
Well, and really, Madam Chair, I think at this point, it's, as I say, Madam Chair and members, this is our chance to really keep the tires on this proposal and take a look at it. It will be back before us again, potentially to take action. We will not be voting today. But if members have questions, Madam Chair, I guess that I would encourage them to ask them now. There may not be any, but again, direct your attention to that D1, which contains the administration's proposal for the summer preschool.
Members, any questions at this point? All right, and not seeing any questions. Chair Pinto, would you like to finish your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so again, as I said before, I will be withdrawing this amendment and ask that you lay over House File 5 for possible action at a later date. Just ask members to be ready for that.
Right. House File 5 is laid over for discussion at a future hearing. I will now return the gavel to Chair Pinto.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so members, as long as we have this amazing team from administration for us, I don't know if anybody has any further questions. I'm not seeing anything. I really want to thank, in addition to the testifiers, Jennifer Sommerfeld, I think, may have been controlling those slides and pulling a lot of this together. I want to thank her, and I know staff at all three agencies, and then the Children's Cabinet, which has just been working enormously hard the last year. I'm so grateful to all of you for the help and assistance and support. Again, not seeing any other hands, and so just want to note that we've heard this morning then, we've heard over the last couple of weeks about individual program presentations. We heard this morning about a couple efforts to link those disparate programs together and connect them, as, and then we certainly heard the proposals. On Thursday, we're going to be hearing a bill then to try to combine those programs even more effectively in the form of a Department of Early Childhood. We'll talk about that. We do expect that one or two more smaller bills may be added. Look for that. We'll do that, get that notice out right away. And then we do expect next week that we'll be hearing the bill on paid family leave in our committee, which we already heard previously is one really major missing piece when national experts look at our state's work. So looking forward to that. Not seeing anything else from members. With that, we are adjourned. Thanks so much. See you Thursday.